Hi, and welcome to the They Call Me the Ghost podcast, a podcast for those looking for good stories, looking for adventure. Today's episode is Scientist Gone Mad and Pushing Limits. He was pushing the limits for the change of a lifetime, and he planned to make many more. Narrated by me, the ghost, each and every time. Let's get started. Hello. It's the ghost. Welcome to your weekly dose of the real world, where truth is stranger than fiction, and things are not always as they seem. We are always so excited about the latest and greatest. We want the new gadgets and toys that make our lives more fun, more enjoyable, and make things easier. We love to think about those things. But what about the things that advance us as people? Advancements in medicine, with our health, space, and travel. There are things that go on outside of our everyday worlds that also deserve our attention, because if they don't affect us right away, that doesn't mean they won't someday. They call me the ghost. I was an agent for the CIA, but today I'm an independent operative working on the side of the mysterious and unbelievable. And today is the story of a job that shows how even one of our world's latest inventions and greatest discoveries of something meant to help us can be flipped and turned into something dangerous in an instant. Take a listen and enjoy. This request came in and it was a bang. You know, whenever things come in from Bowman, a guy I refer to often as the Consequence Man, and if you want to know about what all that is, who is the Consequence Man? If you don't know, please go listen to my preview for this story first. I posted it on Wednesday. It's short, and it will give you a background into Bowman, and it tells you a little bit about what today's episode is about. So again, if you don't know who the Consequence Man is, please listen to that first before this video here. Again, it's short, but it's helpful. But okay, the Consequence Man, Bowman, was traveling when he got one of his visions. He calls on me with an urgent request to meet him right away, right where he is. Says with what he's seen, this issue cannot wait. And I trust Bowman. I know his visions are spot on. And so I do go meet him and I take Jagger and Harley with me. And I'm not coming out with the exact place of where I am this time. This request actually made me kind of angry, and I don't want this place known for what this evildoer was doing. He doesn't deserve that credit, and there are great things happening there, and I want it to stay great. I will say that it was in the western part of the United States, and you can let your imagination take it from there. When I get to where Bowman is, he asks me to meet him in a coffee shop. And I go there for this meeting alone, and he's there, and I sit down, and he gets right into what all happened. Says he was in that very coffee shop, but it was really busy that day, and he ended up sharing a table with another guy. It was the table that we are sitting in for this meeting, actually. So he's sitting there across from this young man. They both had their computers out, their laptops, and Bowman looks at the guy and just takes notice that he's got this nice computer and everything, and he's drinking his latte. But to be blunt about it, this younger guy looked kind of like a scrub. He's wearing a hat, but you can tell his longer hair hasn't been washed in a while. He hadn't washed his clothes either. And at first, Bowman blows it off. But then without realizing it, he finds himself a bit mesmerized by the guy's typing, because he's typing really fast, like he's trying to get something down or out. And then the guy looks up at him and the two lock eyes. And it was right then that Bowman made a connection. Bowman knows something was happening with this person, and he's thrown into one of his visions. It goes fast, and when he snaps out of it, he sees that young man, and he's gone back to his typing. But Bowman's sitting there, and now he's trying to put together what it was he just saw. In his vision, he saw this young man, only he was younger and in a very hard life. He was abused as a child physically by his father. He saw the young man watching his own mother, as she too was beaten. And then Bowman travels forward through this guy's life a bit and sees him struggling. His hard life younger had clearly affected him. But then he sees him with a woman and they have a child. And the young man's happy. Bowman sees him at work. He's on some loading dock. He's in a good mood. He has a smile on his face. Looks like things have turned around for the guy. Bowman flies through these events in his mind, but then he hits a wall, and it hits him hard. In an instant, Bowman's vision takes a dark turn. All of a sudden, Bowman sees him going at it on another guy, completely taking him out. The gory details of which I'm not going to put out there here. I will say, though, it was harsh. And the young guy went on until he finished the job. It didn't make any sense to Bowman. What changed? What went wrong? Where was his family? As he continued to fly through the vision at top speed, he saw the young man move on to others. It was happening over and over again. And then in between things, there was something else odd. There was another man, and he was wearing a white coat like a doctor. He was in a lab. Maybe he was a scientist. But things were very bad. Something went wrong with this young man, and it had to do with that scientist guy. And whatever he was writing on his laptop, Bowman knew that much. Well, he wanted more information. While he's got the source right there, he says he closes his own laptop, and he made some comments about the weather and things to the young guy sitting across from him, which leads to small talk. They exchange names, and I'm going to refer to the young man as Elijah. The two talk a bit more, and then Bowman comes out with it. What is he working on so hard over there? Elijah explains that he's putting things down in his journal, that he's just excited, and that's why he's typing so fast. He wants to get it all down. He tells Bowman that he's about to enter into something big, and he's going on a journey. Says he's very excited to have the slate wiped clean. And Bowman can see that he really is excited, and he comments that it sounds interesting. But what does he mean, start over? The young man responds that he's going to get back what he lost, and his life is going to be good again. He just knows it. But that's not what Bowman saw. At the same time, this guy does seem like a genuinely good person. Someone who wants to be good and have things be good. So it's very confusing. He asks Elijah how one would go about this amazing life change. Elijah tells him that there's a new technique out there, something that can help him change from the inside out. Tells him about how he lost his way, couldn't hold down a job, that he's away from his family right now, but after this change, he's going to get it all back and everything's going to be great. It's a scientist, he says, a scientist who can make him better. He pulls a card out of his pocket. It's a business card, although there's nothing really on it, just a phone number. Tells Bowman he can keep the card in case he ever wants to change his own life. The minute Bowman gets the card in his hands, he tells me that he sees that scientist again. He sees him standing in front of a large group of guys. The room is dark. Not dark as far as lighting, but dark in mood. This scientist is talking to the men and getting them all pumped up. Well, more pumped up than they already are from what Bowman could tell in his vision. You know, all he saw is that they were already busting at the seams. They almost looked like hungry animals, is how he put it. He sees this scientist start handing out these cards. They were like index cards. He's handing it out to the guys, telling them that they now have their missions and to go make it happen. Then Bowman says he was thrust forward and he sees more of the ugliness in this vision. People taken by surprise, people taken down. Again, too ugly to go into detail here. Hopefully you get the point. When he comes out of that short vision, he's looking at Elijah again and now he understands. This guy has no idea what's going on here. And really, neither does he, but he does know that it's not going to be any great life change. Before the two leave that coffee shop, Bowman gives him a small bit of advice, tells him to be careful and that sometimes things are not what they seem, and change really can come from within. But yeah, the guy was way too excited. Bowman could see it. You know, his words went right, you know, in one ear and right out the other ear, pretty much immediately. As Bowman's talking to me, I can see that he's frustrated. You know, he still hasn't figured out what it all is. I mean, are these hitmen? All he knows is that if this happens, this young man, Elijah, and apparently others in the future, will not be changing his life for anything good. He'll be giving up control of his life. It's not what the young man thinks it is. Those men in his vision almost looked like crazed monsters, monsters that were full of adrenaline and ready to take direction. They were no longer regular men, that was for sure. They all had the same expression on their faces, hungry to get that card and get out of that dark place. Bowman still had that business card. And the card alone doesn't prompt any more visions now, though. Bowman said that Elijah was the catalyst into that, and without him, there's nothing for him to see. Unfortunately, this does sound pretty bad, but those are the only leads he has. He's come to me because all he knows for sure is that this scientist needs to be stopped and fast, because if he isn't, it's going to get big. I take the card, I have the description of Elijah, and I'm in the coffee shop. We go over what he can remember about the scientist and that dark place, and that's all I have to go on, but it is a Bowman job, and like I said, I know he's never wrong. So I take the request, and even though I don't really know what any of it is. I go back to our hotel, give my team a debrief, and Harley starts her digging immediately. Unfortunately, without any names or origins of any of this, this was going to be kind of tough, but Harley's just excited that she has a number at least. We decide, too, that we will call the number. Before we do that, though, we set up a very high-tech tracing device. Of course, the person on the other end who's up to no good has most likely rerouted this number a million times, but we still might get some clues as to where this person is or who this person is. When we're ready, Jagger makes the call. We have him do it because he's a male, like Elijah. Maybe that means something. It seems to. All of what Bowman said and talked about had to do with men. So Jagger calls, but all he gets is a voicemail. No big surprise. He leaves an extra long message, though, so that we can follow the trace as far as it will go. The tracing device that I have is something that's been changed, upgraded. It's based on technologies like we used in the CIA. It is very high tech. We see this number travel to a number of different locations, different countries, just all over the place. We finally do see it come back to the US, but we're not getting a specific location. When the guy does call back, and he calls back fairly quickly, actually, so Jagger's story of being hard up worked. But when he calls back, Jagger rambles on some more, tells him about his life and how he got his number and he wants his life to change. During that call, we're able to continue the trace, and it comes back right to where we are, right in that town, and it lands on a building in that town. Harley takes it from there and is able to find out information on this building. She's looking for who is renting there, anyone that works there. She finds out it's not a large building. There's only one man attached to it, a man who I'll refer to as Hamilton Saunders. Okay, that's not all that odd, but then Harley finds out that this man, Hamilton, has a long and impressive history. His studies started out in molecular biology, and he continued on from there. After his schooling and stepping stone jobs, he ended up at a large and leading research facility where he focused on genealogy, DNA, and how the makeup of our bodies affects our behaviors. According to what she found, he was technically still a part of this well-known facility. There was no business attached to the building that he appears to be in as of yet. So what was he doing there? Didn't all the way make sense, but, you know, it's a free country. He can own a building. Maybe he was going to start some kind of facility himself. We just didn't know anything really about him yet. Harley digs deeper, and there was another name that kept popping up along with this Hamilton Saunders. It was kind of weird. I'll call him Leland Sutcliffe. These guys seemed tied at the hip, and at first we wondered if they were an actual pair, but as we learned more, it turned out that they were both just lovers of science, and they had become good buddies. Science was their work, and it was their hobby. You know, okay, so again, no crime there. Harley finds that Leland, though, who seemed all involved, just up and leaves one day, leaves his work at the lab, and seemed to disappear from the sciences altogether. It was sudden. Well, we decide that Leland might be a good place to start. Bowman saw a scientist, so if Leland left, he's a scientist, and what caused that? I'd like to feel him out to see if either he could be our man or if he could be a resource, and I just go straight to him. I go right to his apartment. He answers the door. I have to say, he looked a little disheveled, like he'd maybe been hit by a bus. I tell him that I'm interested in his work and his life and that I had some questions. And I make sure he sees my bag. It's full of notebooks and things. I'm trying to give the impression that maybe I'm a writer or something. And I show up very enthusiastic and excited to talk to him. I'm so matter of fact that I think I caught him off guard because he accepts all this and he lets me in. We start to chat, and Leland explains that he was just overtaken by stress. Things were becoming overwhelming, and he just had to step away, at least for now, from the work that he was doing. I tell him I know about his great work with his friend Hamilton as well, and he confirms that and says that they've stayed pretty close in contact still, which could be good or bad for me at this point. Can't know for sure. We continue with our small talk for a while, and he eventually starts to realize that there's something more to why I'm there. And when he does, it's Leland who gets more interested in talking, especially after I alluded to the fact that something wasn't right. I tell him I am doing research, but I slip in that there might be something going on that needs to be stopped. And I get lucky. It hits him. He hears that, and it gets his attention. And I'm sure right then that he does know something. And I tell him that if there's anything I should know about his good friend or their projects, now would be a good time to share it with me. You know, anything he knows. I lean into him and I tell him I can help. I know he wants to talk. I know he wants to tell someone whatever this is, but he's hesitant. He lets out a big sigh, starts rubbing his hands up and down on his jeans, on his thighs, nervously. He wants to know what I think I know, and how do I think I can even help anyway, and who am I in the first place? I can see this guy is just nervous. He appears very vulnerable, and who knows, maybe whatever all this is what stressed him out in the first place. So I decide to just go for it, and I fill him in on everything. I give it up. He looks at me for a minute, and he sits back, and then he really starts to talk. He tells me his last project, and one he worked on with Hamilton, had to do with ASPD, or antisocial personality disorder, how our genetics contribute to our personalities as well as our personality disorders. But Hamilton got overly interested in it all. He says on a personal level, starts putting in really late hours. He was oftentimes found working alone in the lab. The theory they were working on was that if they could change the genetic makeup of criminals to remove anything or change anything that contributes to their tendencies, wouldn't then that be a true form of rehabilitation? Without it, to the scientific mind that believed in this theory, it seemed almost impossible for hardcore criminals to ever truly rehabilitate. It was just who they were genetically. No matter what they did, they would still be themselves. That part of them would still be inside of them, and they would have a life of fighting it. Although there had been a lot of testing done, playing with the makeup of humans, though, in that way was nowhere near approved. It was still just a dream, a theory. They could continue to try to prove it and research it, and maybe they would get there someday. It was pretty exciting, though, Leland said. If they could really do this, and it could work, it could be great. Eventually, though, Leland says, Hamilton became obsessed with this idea of permanently affecting someone with the characteristics of another. And not the unborn, mind you. We're not talking about creating the perfect baby born to be beautiful in Ivy League. He tells me Hamilton was interested in adults. Severe criminals. He was particularly interested in the serials. They were extreme, and he wanted to be part of the extreme. He'd started talking about it more and more and started spending more and more time alone. Leland said that Hamilton took a leave of absence from the research center, and then he wouldn't really talk about what he was up to, at least not for a while. But then he couldn't help himself. And do you guys ever notice that, you know, how criminals in general, they just can't help opening their mouths after a while. They want to get it out. They want to tell someone all about what they did. It happens a lot. Anyway, Leland goes on to explain some of the world of science in that area, that they're always looking for and researching what makes hardcore criminals different than the average Joe? What is it about them? Is it something that can be identified and fixed? He says they kept looking, but they haven't really ever fully identified that master criminal gene or set of genes. They did identify something called the warrior gene, and they've even used that as part of a defense in different cases for hardcore crime cases. But the problem with the warrior gene, though, was that it only seemed to have this you want to be a criminal effect on those who had disturbing childhoods, extremely abusive homes. If you were raised in a loving home without issues, uncontrollable aggression was not as much of a guarantee, warrior gene or not. Not so good for defense lawyers in the end, but still great for Hamilton because it still showed a link between people's makeup and becoming a severe criminal. Hamilton wanted to test this out and master it. If he could change someone, maybe he could even control them. Leland said it all became too much for him to be around. And it is a lot to take in just listening to it. This guy wants to change the makeup of people and control them. But my confusion was, for what purpose? I mean, why the control if the whole point is to rehabilitate people? But that was the thing, Leland said. He believes that Hamilton's obsession wasn't to heal people. The way his friend started talking, it was as if he wanted to do the complete opposite. His theory was that people are always looking to take others out for whatever their personal reasons are. You know, take out a spouse, an ex, a colleague, an opponent. It's happened all throughout history and will be a need and want by random people in the future as well. And Hamilton thought Wouldn't it be great if he could provide that service? Well, now that hits me hard. And I immediately, you know, I want to know more about this. But saying it all out loud seemed to hit Leland hard too. And all of a sudden, he didn't want to talk anymore. He cut the interview, wished me luck, and then really wanted me to leave. I could tell he was afraid. I could see it on his face, and I understood it. And even though I wanted more, I graciously thanked him and gathered up my things to go. On my way out, I just reassured him that me and my team were going to get to the bottom of this. I mean, this is science, guys, and only the ones behind the scenes of everything, those who know all before it's trickled out to the world, really know what's going on, what's currently possible. If this is possible, then I need to know if it's actually going to happen, because if it is, we could soon have a very big problem on our hands. We do not need or want anyone taking innocent lives and making serious criminals out of them, people whose whole purpose would be to take out others. Well, I get back to the hotel, and there's a lot going on. Our guy Hamilton called Jaeger back, and Jaeger was actually able to keep him on the phone, telling his sob story about a sad life, trying to play it like Elijah's story. And he gets in with the guy enough that he knows that he could call him again if we need him to. For now, though, he tells Hamilton that he's going to think about it, but we've made the connection, and it's good because we might need it later. And there was more. Harley found out that our guy Hamilton is set to advertise for some medical trial. The ad wasn't out yet, but it was scheduled to go out down the road, but not that far down the road. This is still good, though, because it's a sign that maybe he hasn't started anything yet, anything major at least, we can hope. His medical trial would be for a type of personality stabilizer, meant to control those unrested thoughts that people can often suffer from if they've had a violent and abusive childhood. Basically, if you felt like you were suffering from some major PTSD from a childhood life of trauma, then you could be a candidate for this stabilizer that was now being tested. He would advertise it as a chance to start over, a chance to clear your mind and start fresh without all those thoughts. And that makes perfect sense to us based on what we've learned so far. Hamilton was looking for those that were troubled. And at the moment, men suffering, who were higher suicide risk, those that weren't very social, didn't hold down jobs. They were perfect because they fit the formula and they would not be missed. He even offered to pay his subjects. I mean, if this got out, he would have no problem getting those willing participants. It's pretty sick if you think about it, but this wouldn't be the first time we've heard of questionable testing in science, is it? Science is a great thing, but not so great if you're using it for bad things. With this information, I need to meet with Leland again. We all do. We need to know from a professional in the field how this all would even work. I call him up, and with enough pressure, I finally get him to agree to come down to the hotel and talk to me again, meet the team. I get a conference room so we can be private, and we wait for him there. He's late, but he does show up. We are still trying to wrap our heads around the fact that this is indeed possible. But if we can accept that, then how would this all happen? I let Leland know that we are planning to go to that location where we think Hamilton is, that building. And I need to know what we should be looking for. Should all of this be what is really going on? Okay, now bear with me, guys. I'm not a scientist. But let me share with you in the simplest way I can what Leland explained to us that night in the hotel as far as how this could even happen. How could Hamilton even pull this off? Okay, so we have chromosomes, right? And in our chromosomes, we have strands of DNA. And inside those strands of DNA are the chemical building blocks to who we are, of which there are four. When you hear a scientist say that they've sequenced someone's DNA, that means that they understand the order of those chemical building blocks, okay? For instance, if an average person's sequence has a 50-50 ratio of something I'll call A and B, but criminal number one over here has a ratio of 70-30 of A and B, and that sequence affects their aggression and raised adrenaline and a need for certain stimuli, it's the sequencing that helps us understand that difference. All Hamilton would need then to change someone would be a little bit of their DNA. He would start out with a blood sample, for instance. So we might see that. Hamilton would then need to manipulate those samples. Like in my example, maybe taking the 50-50 and making it a 70-30. If he is trying to make criminals out of a non-criminal, well, a non-criminal with potential is how he would see them. we would have an area set up for this. We might see robotics, scanners, things like that. He would then also have an area set up for controlled conditions, where he would take his altered blood and inject it into a synthesized cell that he's already made in his lab. That cell would undergo mitosis, meaning that cell would divide, like single cell reproduction. It would divide, and he'd let it go until he had a lot of it. So he would have a batch of that somewhere for each of his subjects. Then, once he's ready to administer treatment, for instance, when Elijah gets there, he would then drain him of as much blood as he could without killing him, and then finally infuse his now altered version into them. And so he would need a place or a station for that. The best and most effective way for this to work, according to Leland, would be to inject his version right into their heart. The new blood would be the most oxygenated, so the body would look at it, and it would start to make those types of blood cells. The old cells would eventually die off. Eventually, all of his subject's DNA would replicate into the synthesized version that he created. And voila! As unbelievable as that all sounded at first, it did make some sense to me. And all I could say to all of it was, wow. Leland eventually left and wished us luck. And before he went, though, he wanted us to know that Hamilton used to be a very good man. He really wanted us to know that. He hoped no one would get hurt. The ideas in science can do strange things to you when you get in deep, he said. The possibilities are endless, and that can be a problem. It's mind-boggling, but it's also tempting. Said it was a harsh reality that something he loved, something that was his life and meant for good, could get so far off in the wrong direction that it could become something so ugly and destructive and wrong. The last bit of awesome news that Leland lays on us before he really did leave was that Hamilton mentioned launching his project on the night of the full moon. Well, the next one of those was in 2 days. We're up early the next day, and the three of us head over to this building. There are no cars there. There were no other businesses in the area. It was actually Saturday, so it's pretty dead, but there's nothing right next to his building. We park off a ways, bring some things with us, and we're able to break into the back doors. It had pretty good security on it, though, better than I thought it would have for a building that didn't appear to have anything in it yet. And we get inside, and just as we thought, there's nothing there. No business was registered to this place yet. I mean, it's a nice enough place, a little older, it's empty. There wasn't a single phone, computer, or even a chair anywhere. Well, Jaeger starts running all over the place, and he's pretty fast, and he finds a door in one of the back corners, and it's not marked, you know, as a stairway or anything else like the other ones we saw, and it's locked. It takes us a while, but we do get through it. We find a stairway, one that goes down. It went down 2 flights. And I have to say, the more down we got, it got a little creepy. We get down there and we start exploring very quietly because you just never know. It was a bit storage, a bit boiler room from what we could tell. And it was winter, by the way, so everything's in full swing down there. There are different noises happening. There was nothing unusual, though, not at first. After walking through the basement, now back towards the front of the building, there was an area that started to open up more, and we see that there are lights on, and there's movement and sounds. Somebody was there. Somebody was using this place. We walk along the edges of this area very slowly. It was like a scientist's dark man cave, and then we saw him. It was Hamilton. He looked to be in a pleasant mood. He looked very comfortable moving about. He looks as he should if he is doing what we think he is. He's focused and he's excited. I mean, his big day's coming up. There's a lot of big stuff for us to hide behind. So we get ourselves situated and we start to really look around at what we're dealing with. What we notice first is that he's definitely doing injections, but they're a little bit more elaborate than your average needle prick. He's got 7 chairs and they're all lined up in a half circle. Behind those chairs, there's a large computer-type thing, and that has spider-like tubes coming out of it, smaller ones that each went to one of the chairs. And there were more tubes that stuck right into the back of those chairs. And then a long tube came out the front side where your shoulder might be. I mean, that would be for the heart injections that Leland told us about. The chairs also have metal cuffs on them for both the arms and the legs, and they're equipped with robotic arms for what we don't know. We see a glass room separated out from the rest of the place, but still within the same area, that must be where his controlled environment is. That's all we can deduce. He's got a large steel fridge in there. It's a great place to hold samples and batches. This really does look exactly like what Leland explained to us. It was like we'd found ourselves in some kind of gothic science fiction movie. I mean, if Frankenstein himself walked right up to me from behind and tapped me on the shoulder right then, I wouldn't have been surprised. It was a strange place. But Hamilton did somehow manage to keep it clinical as well. I mean, the guy was a professional. Above all his equipment were these big lights. They were large glass spheres, six of them lined up in two rows. And the room had this bluish-greenish glow to it. There were a lot of wires overhead, open and connecting to all the different moving parts to this place. Some of them gave off a quiet crackling. I mean, this lab was old meets new. What we didn't count on, though, was him being there. But at least we were able to get in undetected and could check out what was going on. And now the building made more sense. With Hamilton there, though, we could only look from the outside, and we needed to go. We would continue our observations, and then we would return in 2 days prepared for this night of the full moon. So fast forward to that day, and we arrive early. He's not there this time, which is great for us. We had more freedom to move about the place, and while looking around, Jaeger noticed something, and then we all saw it. We didn't see it the last time. Way above, hidden in between the different pipes and wires and things, were these iron bars. They looked like old prison walls, and after inspecting them more closely, we realize that they're set up to be lowered, and if lowered, they would surround this little chamber. A way to keep something in or possibly keep things out? Either way, it would separate the core of this chamber from everything else around it. The bars were thick and strong. We are able to find the control box for these walls, and we disconnect power to the switches, and then we keep looking around. I put myself in one of the chairs, and I just sat there and imagined this man manipulating my mind and my person with his twisted plans. I didn't sit there long, though. It gave me an uneasy and creepy feeling. They were like dentist chairs almost, only they had those cuffs, and they were set up for something much different than a teeth cleaning. Inside the closed-off glass area he had, we opened the large steel fridge, and we find vial after vial and bags of what looked like blood. We also found cardboard boxes full of even more chemicals and small glass bottles. Nothing's marked. And surely, he's done this to protect himself. I mean, in case anyone did find him down here. If anyone came, they would most likely not be an awarded scientist like himself. And he would play on their ignorance. He could tell them anything he wanted about what everything was. Who would know? We saw little robot machines. In another smaller fridge, we found sealed plates that would be for keeping DNA and other samples. He has a sequencer machine that's hooked up to monitors. He really did a good job of putting it all together, and Leland did know exactly what we would find. His information was a great help. We now knew what we were dealing with. We found his files, and we go through those, and he has a few spread out on the table as well. Those are on the big guys. I'm talking Bundy, Gacy, guys like that. We look inside, and we find that information that Leland was also telling us about with regards to the DNA sequencing. And this guy wasn't messing around. I mean, these top guys have access to the good stuff. The DNA sequencing of top criminals like Bundy and Gacy and Kemper. It's not so you can recreate those guys later, which is what Hamilton was looking to do. Scientific data is meant to advance what we know so we can learn. It's certainly not to recreate what we've taken care of. We don't want more BTK killers, but Hamilton does. We get through everything, and we get to know the place enough so that we're going to be able to move around it more easily when the time comes. I've also hooked up to his three computers, and I am downloading all of the information that they've got. I have a very high-powered little device for that. We expect this all to go quickly, actually. I mean, once he arrives, we plan to nab him, get our information, and get everything to the right people, and be done with it. And so, with all that going on, we turn off all the lights, we close everything back up like it was, and we just wait. And we discuss a little bit about what we found. I mean, Hamilton is testing subjects now to see if it works. With what Bowman saw, we can only gather that if it does work, with Elijah, for example, his ultimate goal would be to build that army that we saw. Small at first, but we all know how technology spreads. Who knows where this could go? If it all worked, anyone could be anything in the end. We don't have to wait all that long before Hamilton shows up. He's in a very good mood, as we'd expect. He's about to start something that, if it goes well, would be a success and would help him gain the control and power he so desperately seeks. What we did not expect is that he didn't arrive before his test subjects. He arrived with them, and they were also excited. It's Elijah and two other men. He thanks them for giving him their samples ahead of time and tells them that he's all set. He asks them to take a seat and tells them it'll go fast and that they should get ready for greatness. This is unfortunate because we don't want anything to happen to these guys, and we don't want what we do to put them in jeopardy. So we just stand back for a bit. We wait to see what Hamilton does. I mean, I can see his big eyes, and he's practically drooling. He's expecting to create a group of madmen that will willingly take out others. It is crazy. It's dangerous, and it goes against our entire human instinct to survive. He's creating on-demand executioners. Hamilton starts to get the guys situated in their seats. He hasn't stuck anyone with a needle yet, so that's good, but he does tell them to roll up their sleeves. And the guys have absolutely no idea what's really going on. They're actually thanking Hamilton for giving them this opportunity. They think they're going to be improved human beings when this is done. And they're going to get paid, and they're going to go on to live these awesome lives. Out of nowhere, Jagger's foot hits this random metal can that was on the ground. You know, it's very dark on the outskirts. We can't see anything. And Hamilton hears it. He stops everything and he starts to look around. The young men, they didn't hear it. They don't hear a thing. But Hamilton starts walking around the perimeters of this little setup and he's trying to see if someone's out there. He even calls out to find out if anyone's out there. Well, of course, no one comes, but he's not exactly settled with that. He lets out a long and frustrating breath, takes a more firm stance. I mean, we know we have to do something, and we decide to send Jagger in. He's going to play the role he did on the phone. While Hamilton continues to call out to whoever's out there, Jagger removes any tools and weapons he has. He pulls out his shirt, he messes up his hair, and then he just walks right out, and he immediately starts apologizing. Says he's very sorry that he just showed up, but he heard about where this place was, and he really wanted in. He explains that he was the guy that called. He didn't mean to interrupt, he just really wanted to be a part of it all. Well, this is not what Hamilton expected, and it was a good play. He walks up to Jagger and he starts to check him out. Jagger just keeps talking, playing it up that he's really messed up and that he had everything, but his childhood haunts him and he just can't get away from it. He can't hold down a job and he's broke, things like that. Hamilton takes it and he gets Jagger into a chair with the other guys. So Jagger sits there and he continues to just ramble on and on. And while he does, Hamilton goes over to one of the columns, and it's the column where those switches are for those iron doors. And he flips them on, and he turns around smiling, but then nothing happens. So he flips them on and off some more, but still nothing happens. He's looking at Jagger now, very suspecting. He's breathing harder. He walks over to the main computer, and he types in like two things, and it activates the cuffs in the chairs. The guys are all now locked in, including Jagger. After that happens, those little robotic arms, the ones on the chairs, activate, and little needles pop out of them, and the arms stick them into their forearms. Hamilton is starting the blood-draining process. So we need to deactivate those chairs. So that's where Harley and I head. I can see my downloads, and they're almost done. He's not going to get away with this, not if I can help it. Harley and I get to work on the chairs, and we're moving as fast as we can because the guys, including Jagger, are starting to get pretty pale. Hamilton is at his computer, but talking to Jagger, asking him, you know, who he works for, things like that. He hasn't seen Harley and I yet. We are able to deactivate two of the chairs, but Hamilton hears the cuffs release, and that's when Harley and I step out, because he's going to see us. Harley and I break out our pulse guns, and I tell the two guys, it's the two guys that I don't know, to slip out from under those needles and back away. They were being drained quickly, though, and one of them actually slips and falls to the ground, but they do manage to crawl their way out of the main area. Harley keeps her gun on Hamilton, and I work to get Elijah's chair deactivated. And I have to start with him because he's much smaller than Jagger. I get him out, and then I move to work on Jagger's chair. Harley looks over at us, and Jagger isn't looking very good at this point. And in that tiny second of Harley just looking over to check on Jagger, Hamilton pulls a syringe out of his right pocket of his jacket, and he sticks it in the side of Harley's neck, and she falls to the floor. But right before she hits the ground, she's able to get one shot off. It wasn't a direct hit to his chest or anything, but it did hit his legs, and it was enough to take him out. But I knew it wasn't going to last long. I'm almost done with Jagger's chair. I mean, he's looking very, very pale at this moment, and I need to get him off of that needle. Well, I finally get the chair done and the cuffs open up, and I'm able to slide his arm out from under his needle. I get Jagger out of his chair, but he falls to the floor. And when he falls to the floor, he lands on my legs. So I'm stuck in that second. And while that's happening, Hamilton comes to. He comes to enough anyway. We're looking, he and I, directly at each other, and I'm trying to get out from under Jagger. Hamilton reaches into his left pocket and pulls out a black box, and he starts to scoot himself backwards. He hits a button on that box. This was his backup. He had some kind of remote. He hits this button, and I see one of the computers start to smoke. They are armed to self-destruct. He's trying to get rid of evidence. I know, though, that my downloads should almost be done. I have it set to move very fast. Hamilton hits another button on his remote, and it activates those iron walls. They immediately engage and start to lower. They're coming down pretty fast, so I'm scrambling to get Jagger over to the edge. I'm scooting myself, I'm taking him with me. I mean, it's a race to see if anyone is jailed inside of those walls. I mean, Hamilton's having a very hard time with his legs, and I'm trying to move very fast. Can someone win here? I can tell you I intend to. Jagger eventually falls off of me, and I'm able to move him and get his legs so his whole body is outside the area. So then I rush over to Harley. She's completely out. I move fast, and I look over to Hamilton. I give him a grin of my own, and then I shoot him with my pulse gun. And I do get him directly in the chest. He falls back immediately, just short of the edge. The walls are almost down now, though, and I need to get Harley out of there. I grabbed her by the feet, and I just start pulling. I mean, I've got about 30 seconds left before those walls slam to the ground. I get on the floor and I pull Harley by her hips, and then I'm pulling her by her shoulders. And just as I get her outside of the area, those iron walls slam to the ground and they lock in place. So I'm sitting there. My team is knocked out. I've got scared young men who have no idea what's going on or who we are, but we got him. I go over to where the computers are. They're backed up to the edge of his workspace, and I'm able to disconnect my downloads. They're done, and I have what I need. I call in the right people, and again, I just wait. Hamilton starts to come to again and realizes he's inside his own walls as very heavily armed men break through that basement door and rush over to where we are. It's done. And this is why I always listen to the consequence man. When Bowman told me this was urgent, he wasn't kidding. We only had a matter of days, and it got down to hours and seconds. If Hamilton would have succeeded by enclosing us in that room, there's no telling what would have happened then. You know, I always like to have backups on jobs that I do, but this was a job that we had to move quickly on. And unfortunately, Frankie, Scarlett, and Ryder, they weren't even in the country at the time. They were doing some research on another job that we were thinking of taking around that same time. I mean, there was nothing we could do about that. There would have been no one there to help us get out. It's a scary thought. It's times like that that, you know, you have to wonder what forces in the universe help things align to go the right way. This move by Hamilton, if he had succeeded, if Bowman didn't run into Elijah that day, at that exact time, in that exact coffee shop, if he did not connect with him, no one would have any idea what was going on. Leland was in denial. He was too stressed out overall to do anything about it himself. He would have found out eventually. And who knows, maybe he would have been right. Maybe he would have become a victim. There are a lot of stories out there with good versus evil as the base. But a lot of them are just stories. There is a reason that these types of stories have been out there for so long. It's because there was a realization at some point that good versus evil is a real thing. We are in it every day. We can only control what we do, though. I mean, if we see it, are we scared? Are we stressed out? Do we walk away and are we in denial like Leland? It does take guts at times, but remember, as powerful as evil is, good has power as well. There's always a chance for either one to win. And as we move forward, we can only hope that in the very dire and serious situations we find ourselves in, it's the good that prevails. I want to thank you very much for listening to this story about one of my jobs. It moved very quickly, but it absolutely did need to be stopped. Harley ended up in the hospital She had to be cleansed of the very heavy sedative that Hambleton gave her. Jagger, he was tended to in the ambulance. Those were not fun moments. But sometimes things like that do happen. We always know there's a risk, and even though we can make it out most of the time, sometimes we don't make it out unscathed. Again, thank you for listening. I appreciate you taking the time to be here this Friday or over the weekend. And as you know, I will always be back with more. So until next time, and I will talk to you all soon.